Welcome to the most controversial topic in the world, and that, of course, is Islam. You are listening to The Logic of Islam with Dr. Carl Goldberg. And the purpose of this show, as always, is to motivate you to help spread the truth about Islam and the Islamic threats to our fellow citizens. We absolutely must do that because we do not have enough of our fellow citizens who understand the truth about Islam, and so they are unable to provide the support to our legislators who need to take defensive measures by passing legislation in order to protect us. But because it's so controversial, they won't do that unless they feel sure that they have the backing of their constituents. That's why it is so important to increase the backing of these legislators by spreading the truth about Islam to all of our fellow citizens. If we don't do that, there's just no way to counter the Islamic threats, because the major Islamic threats, as we've mentioned before in this program, there are three of them. The first one is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is threatening to get nuclear weapons, and eventually they will use it, if not necessarily to blow up our cities, they would certainly use it to explode a nuclear device over our atmosphere and essentially eliminate or destroy our whole electronic system for most of the country, which would lead to millions of deaths because there would be no more water. The water purification plants would be put out of service. Medical services would be no longer existent because everything in our society depends on electronics, and that would all be knocked out. Food production and distribution, you name it. So all of this would be knocked out by an electromagnetic pulse bomb. This is the major threat from the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, the second major existential threat from Islam is, of course, mass Muslim immigration. Why? Well, we'll be talking about this more on the show also, but mass Muslim immigration is a threat because they all bring with them the ideology of Islam, which prevents them from assimilating. Now, assimilation can be looked at in various ways. We're talking about assimilation of values. Islamic values are in contradiction to American values, and when these Muslim immigrants come here, not all of them, some of them would come here in order to escape Islam, and that is also true. However, most of them will come here because they are still Islamic. They will form Islamic communities. They will support the Islamic community organizations and the mosques, who are always supremacists, and they're eventually aiming for an American Islamic Republic, and that is the existential threat from Muslim immigration, because they will increase the proportion of their proportion, because they have more children, because they are also polygamous, and so we have a great deal to fear from mass Muslim immigration. They simply do not share our values. Again, that's not a 100% generalization. Many Muslims are coming here in order to escape Islam, not to practice it. That's fine. But the ones who are coming here to practice it, they are a threat. The third major threat from Islam, of course, is the so-called stealth jihad organized by the Muslim Brotherhood. This involves infiltration of American institutions with Muslims who are dedicated to Islam, not to America. It happens all the time. They're in our Defense Department, they're in the State Department, they're in the National Security Council, they're in probably in the FBI, you name it. They are everywhere. They were brought in, first of all, by Clinton, then by Bush, and of course by Obama, who then greatly expanded their influence in the American government. This is the stealth jihad, the program of the Muslim Brotherhood, says very clearly that they are here in order to promote a civilization jihad, which means undermining and destroying American civilization from within. That is from their own documents. And so the only way to deal with these major threats is through legislation. Talking about these last two threats, Muslim migration, well, the president does have the authority to prohibit anyone from coming to the United States whom he deems to be a threat to America. This needs to be supported by legislation, and that is why we need to support our legislators in this endeavor to prohibit or severely restrict Muslim immigration on the basis of the fact that they, that is, the Muslims, support values which are contradictory to American values. We can do this through extreme vetting, as President Trump has said. Well, this actually has to be done, but it has to be done by people who understand what the threat is. And the threat, of course, is the ideology of Islam with its values, and in extreme vetting, we can test for that. We can ask, for example, give them quotations from the Quran, which call for killing non-Muslims and otherwise denigrating non-Muslims, as well as women. And we can ask these prospective applicants for American immigration, ask them, do they agree with it? Well, that puts them on the spot, of course, because how can they publicly disagree with what their God says? But we need to do that. They may lie, of course, it's possible. On the other hand, we need to try that, because then afterwards, when they begin supporting the Quran and attending mosques, we can then deport them for having lied on the visa application. So that's one thing. Another thing, we need to pass legislation which has been before Congress for about almost 2 years. It's called the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act. We need to support the congressmen and the senators and urge them to support this Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act. Once we declare the Muslim Brotherhood to be a terrorist organization, we can begin to take action against it and all of its many subsidiaries in the United States, including the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood has already been declared a terrorist organization by several Muslim countries, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations has also been declared a terrorist organization by at least one Muslim country. So there is precedent for this, and the fact that Muslim countries have already done this, that should be an indication to us that they understand something about the Muslim Brotherhood that most Americans don't understand. Well, your job is to please help our legislators understand the threat from the Muslim Brotherhood and the threat from Muslim immigration. And so please urge them to support restrictions on Muslim immigration and to support the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act. And now that we are heading into an election, people are beginning to run candidates for the election next year. Please talk to all of the candidates. You can call them, you can send them emails and ask them, what is their stand on the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act? And urge them that you will support them if they take a stand in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act, and that you and your friends will not support them if they don't take a stand in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act. They need to know that the public is interested in this. If they think that the public is not interested in it, as is the case right now, they will not touch the issue because it's a controversial one and nobody likes controversy. So please use all of your influence, whatever you have in your own sphere of influence, to go out and talk to people, especially people who you are not already in contact with. Just strike up a conversation with them about the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. Let them know what the story is. Let them know what is in the Quran. They need to become more aware of Islam, and that Islam, of course, is not a religion like other religions. We've talked about that on this show many times, and I'll be happy to send you quotations from the Islamic religious authorities who tell us that Islam is not a religion like other religions. And it follows logically, and that's why we call this program The Logic of Islam. There are many elements of logic in Islam and in our approach to Islam, that if Islam is not a religion like other religions, logically it should not be treated like other religions. That makes sense, and people need to understand why that makes sense. Please send me an email at ideologyofislam@cox.net, ideologyofislam@cox.net, and I will be happy to send you these writings of the Muslim religious authorities, the Islamic religious authorities, who explain to us just in what way Islam is not a religion like other religions. And in short, they explain it that Islam is a complete way of life. That means totalitarian Sharia law. Totalitarian means it covers everything, and that's the same thing that complete way of life means. We need to get that point across when we talk about Islam. Okay, today we have a number of topics, as we usually do, and we try to explain the goings-on in the Islamic world and link them up to Islamic doctrine. The first one we want to deal with today is an article by Cynthia Farahat, an excellent article, which draws attention to Al-Azhar University. The article is entitled, "Is Al-Azhar University a Global Security Threat?" Now remember, Al-Azhar University is the oldest university in Sunni Islam, about 1,000 years old, and it is something like the Vatican to Catholics. In other words, Al-Azhar University is the source of religious authority for Sunni Islam, and Sunni Islam makes up approximately 90% of the Muslim world, which comes out to about maybe 1.5 billion people or so, or 1.3 billion people. The rest are Shiite Islam, and by the way, there's not a whole lot of difference for our purposes between Shiite Islam and Sunni Islam in terms of the threat to non-Muslims. That is, the jihad, the declaration of war against non-Muslims, that is the same in Sunni Islam as it is in Shiite Islam. There are other differences between the two, but for the most part, those differences do not concern us. Well, what about Al-Azhar? Remember also, Al-Azhar was the university that President Obama spoke to when he made his maiden speech to the Muslim world in July of 2009. Well, what is Al-Azhar University? What do they stand for? Let's talk about this article by Cynthia Farahat. She says, Al-Azhar University is the world's largest Sunni Islamic educational institution, and it is where many of the world's most brutal terrorists received their formal religious training. This is to be expected, given the nature of the material taught there. Al-Azhar has thousands of affiliated mosques, schools, learning centers, and universities around the world, including the so-called Islamic American University in the state of Michigan. The institution has also been unofficially controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood for decades. Well, the Al-Azhar, of course, actually created the ideology which lies at the base of the Muslim Brotherhood. So according to the most recent data released by the Egyptian government, there were 297,000 students studying at Al-Azhar University in 2013-2014. And in 2015, there were 39,000 foreign students studying at Al-Azhar. Why is this important? Because these foreign students studying at Al-Azhar absorb all of this vile ideology of Islam that Al-Azhar is teaching, and then they return to their home countries, to the Muslim communities in their home countries, and they spread that ideology in those host countries. The article goes on to say, these students are taught the theological legitimacy of, among other things, cannibalizing infidels, gruesome ways to torture non-Muslims to death, and the importance of raping and humiliating non-Muslim women. This explains why numerous Egyptian public figures and intellectuals have called for a terrorism investigation of Al-Azhar University. For example, Egyptian historian Syed Al-Kemani called for the Egyptian government to designate Al-Azhar University as a terrorist organization. In 2015, an Egyptian newspaper published an investigative report about the curriculum at Al-Azhar University. According to the report, one of the books called Al-Azhar's high school students, stating that any Muslim can kill an apostate, this is quotation, any Muslim can kill an apostate and eat him as well as kill infidel warriors, even if they are young or female, and they can also be eaten because they are not granted any protection, unquote. Now, this sounds absolutely outrageous, and yet this is apparently a book that is being used by Al-Azhar University in their high school classes. And on the treatment of non-Muslims, the report quotes the same book as saying, quote, to preserve oneself from the evil of an infidel, any Muslim can gouge their eyes out or mutilate their hands and legs or sever one arm and one leg, unquote. Well, let's talk about this last thing, part about severing one arm and one leg. This comes straight out of the Quran, verse 533, where it says that the punishment for resisting the spread of Islam, for resisting Allah and his messenger, that is, resisting the spread of Islam, among the punishments are crucifixion and amputation of opposite limbs, an arm and a leg. The article goes on to say, even Muslims are not safe from Al-Azhar's teachings. According to the same report, another book says, quote, any Muslim is allowed to kill a fornicator, a warrior, or a Muslim who misses prayer, even without permission of the ruling imam. Well, what's this about missing prayer? According to Sharia law, all male Muslims, not females, but all male Muslims over the age of puberty, are required to attend Friday prayers, the communal prayer, and if they don't, this manual on Sharia law says that they are to be executed. This has actually been done, to my knowledge, in Somalia by Al-Shabaab and by Boko Haram in Nigeria. These are the so-called extremist Muslim militant groups, but they're merely following Sharia law, which is standard. The book goes on to say, the article goes on to say, this is expected given the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood dominates the organization. Not only does the Muslim Brotherhood use the university to recruit hundreds of thousands of students to adopt ISIS-style beliefs, the Brotherhood also used the organization to train young people for combat. For example, in 2006, a video leaked from inside Al-Azhar showed 50 masked young members of the Muslim Brotherhood in black uniforms performing a military exercise in front of the head of Al-Azhar University, resulting in a government investigation and arrests in what became known as the case of the Al-Azhar militia. Thus, it should not come as a surprise that many of the world's most brutal Islamists either worked for Al-Azhar or graduated from it. For example, Boko Haram leader Shekau is a graduate from Al-Azhar. Also, the first leader of Al-Qaeda, Abdullah Assam, graduated Al-Azhar. The spiritual mentor of Osama bin Laden and a leader of the international arm of Al-Qaeda, Omar Abdel Rahman, known as the Blind Sheikh, was a scholar at Al-Azhar. Remember that the so-called Blind Sheikh is the one who organized the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. He recently died in jail. The Nazi Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, who died in 1974 but was an ally of Hitler, he studied at Al-Azhar University. As well, Osama al-Masri, the mastermind of the Russian plane crash over Sinai 2 years ago, was also a graduate of Al-Azhar University. And not only is Al-Azhar involved in the spreading of the violent Sunni Wahhabi sect, the government-funded institution, that is, Al-Azhar, receives government funds, uses Egyptian blasphemy law to imprison critics of its radical teachings. Now, the article calls this radical teachings. However, what does radical mean? Radical means going to the roots. And so, in a sense, Al-Azhar is radical because it teaches the roots of Islam. That is, it teaches what is in the Quran and the sayings of Muhammad. So calling it radical does not mean that it is fringe or extremist. It means that it goes to the roots of Islam. The article says that this halts any hope for Islamic reformation. We need to talk about that a little bit more because we've talked about it before and we'll be talking about it again. There are many non-Muslims in the West who think that Islam can be reformed and should be reformed, and so they are pushing the line about hoping for Islamic reformation. Well, folks, Islamic Reformation is a contradiction in terms, because the fundamental proposition, and here we get back to the logic of Islam again, and we need to understand this, the logic of Islam is based on the fundamental proposition of Islam that the Quran is Allah's literal word, not the inspired word. It's the literal word, and therefore it must be read and understood literally wherever it is possible to do so. And the literal word means that no human being can reform it. So reform in Islam is theoretically impossible, and therefore calling for Islamic reformation is simply barking up the wrong tree and diverting us from understanding the real nature of our enemy. It is the Quran that is taught and preached in every mosque in the world, and the Quran prohibits reform. Sharia law based on the Quran prohibits reform, and in fact punishes it with death, because anybody who tries to reform any part of their God's literal word is considered to be an apostate. And so when the author here talks about halting any hope for Islamic reformation because of the Egyptian blasphemy law, no, it's not a matter of Egyptian blasphemy law. It is Islamic blasphemy law, which Egypt has incorporated into its legal system. But it's Islamic blasphemy law. It is part of Islam all over the world. And sometimes it is, in fact, many times in the Muslim countries, Muslim-majority countries, it is incorporated one way or another into the law of the land. But it is not Egyptian blasphemy law. It is blasphemy law. For example, the president of Al-Azhar University recently declared that Muslim scholar by the name of El-Bihari, who was previously imprisoned in Egypt for blasphemy, it declared him to be an apostate of Islam. Well, that's perfectly according to Sunni theology. And by the way, not only Sunni theology, it is also Shiite theology, because in the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is Shiite, there is the same anti-blasphemy laws. And of course, blasphemy, as we mentioned, is punishable by death according to standard Sharia law. So Al-Azhar is also responsible for the apostasy fatwa that resulted in the murder of Egyptian secular figure Farag Fouda in 1992, and after an uproar in Egypt against the university for essentially placing a hit contract, a murder contract, on Mr. Bihari by calling him an apostate of Islam, its president was forced to resign. That's the president of Al-Azhar. However, the militant teachings remain untouched. Of course, the militant teachings remain untouched because these so-called militant teachings are standard Islamic teachings, and nobody can touch them because they are standard Islamic teachings. They come from the Quran. The article goes on to say, Al-Azhar was responsible for the imprisonment of another very popular Muslim scholar, Sheikh Mohammed Abdallah Nasser, for adopting a non-theocratic modern interpretation of Islam, which landed him an unprecedented 13-year prison sentence for blasphemy with hard labor. Well, what's this about a non-theocratic modern interpretation of Islam? Yes, there are some Muslims who are so fed up with Islam, but they still retain their Islamic identity. And so they're trying desperately to develop a so-called non-theocratic modern interpretation of Islam. Well, of course, it cannot work, because that means revising the Quran, and as we've already seen, revising the Quran entails the death penalty. And so it cannot work, and so you have these few of these moderate Muslims who are brave enough to speak out about a non-theocratic modern interpretation, but that's absolutely impossible. You cannot have a modern interpretation of the Quran, because God's literal words are supposed to be eternal. That's the fundamental proposition of Islam, that God's words are eternal, and they cannot be modernized. They cannot change according to the times. Last month, the article continues, this is kind of interesting, that China demanded from Israel that it deport Chinese students studying at Al-Azhar. Why? Well, because these Chinese students are learning this ideology of Islam, which is supremacist, which means that Islam must take over the world, and including the host country. And so these Chinese Muslim students will be going back to China to stir up trouble. There's already trouble with the Chinese Muslim minority. And so China wants these students to be deported back to China. And the obvious reason could be that China is proactively attempting to protect itself from possible terrorist recruitment at Al-Azhar. Well, it's not only terrorist recruitment. That's certainly part of it. But it's a matter of spreading the supremacist ideology of Islam. In long term, that is the Muslim Brotherhood strategy, is a long-term Islamization of the world. And so these Chinese students would go back to China, and if they don't commit outright terrorist acts, they would nevertheless promote Islam to spread Islam in China. The article goes on to say, Western governments and their Egyptian counterpart, that is the Egyptian government, should investigate Al-Azhar University and its affiliated institutions for possible ties to terrorism. Well, indeed, they should. And if President El-Sisi is serious about combating Islamic militancy, and he is, his government must immediately halt its funding of the university and stop Al-Azhar's daily terror indoctrination of future Islamic terrorists like the ones they have already produced. Well, President Sisi is in a very difficult position. He is president of a Muslim country. And he depends on the Muslim population. He does not want a revolt among the Muslim population of Egypt because that is about 90% of the population. And so he has to tread very carefully. He, on the one hand, suppresses the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the active manifestation of the ideology of Al-Azhar, but he cannot crush Al-Azhar because that would go against Islam itself. Next item. In the United Kingdom, there's a new mega mosque that is featuring giant loudspeakers for a call to prayer, which can be heard 15 miles away. This is an item by Robert Spencer's at his Jihad Watch. And by the way, I urge everybody here to go to jihadwatch.org and look at the articles that are being presented by Robert Spencer there, and subscribe to the daily alert so you can then choose whether to read or not read the articles that he sends around, but it's certainly worth knowing about them in any case. This particular one says that artificial amplification is a relatively recent invention in Islam. For 1,300 years of Islam, the muezzin, that's the Muslim who gets up on the minaret to announce the prayers, he sounded the call to prayer from the minaret with his unaided voice only. Well, this goes back to the time when there was a mosque surrounded by a Muslim village, and so it was a small village, and it was certainly possible for the muezzin to announce the prayers with his unaided voice. However, these loudspeakers are a new declaration of supremacy. It's a declaration of who Britain's new masters are, and the Birmingham Mosque is only the beginning. So this new mega mosque has speakers that can be heard up to 15 miles away. This mega mosque is going to be built in the center of Birmingham and will have a speaker system that can be heard 15 miles away and will broadcast the call to prayer across the city five times a day. The mega mosque has been granted special permission by the Labour-led Birmingham City Council to have the giant speaker system installed due to a special provision of the Local Communities Act, which allows religious groups to break noise abatement laws. Well, churches ring their bells once on Sunday, but Muslims announce the call to prayer five times a day, 7 days a week. And here we have a giant speaker system that is going to be louder than a jet engine and will be heard up to 15 miles away. The speaker system will primarily be used to announce the call to prayer in Arabic five times a day, starting at 5 o'clock in the morning. Again, the fact that they use these giant speaker systems is another indication of Islamic superiority. It's a way of telling all of the non-Muslims that we are here and we are dominant and you can't stop us. Next item, from Calgary, Canada. There's a Muslim website that defends female circumcision and attacks the Jewish media for criticizing female circumcision. Here's a website serving the Calgary Muslims, which this, by the way, comes from a Canadian newspaper, the National Post, and which the website made a lengthy pitch for female circumcision, arguing that the practice has immense value and blaming its poor reputation on Jewish-controlled media. The provocative blog post by a foreign Islamic scholar drew strong rebukes this week from researchers and advocates concerned about female genital mutilation and from a major Jewish group. It also resurrected questions about whether genital cutting of young women is taking place in Canada. Well, apparently it is, just like it's taking place in the United States. But here we have a Muslim website saying that female circumcision is the correct thing to do. We'll talk about this here, the article goes on to say. The essay advocates only removing the prepuce or layer of skin over the clitoris, calling it similar to taking off the foreskin in male circumcision. However, all forms of female genital cutting have been outlawed in Canada since 1997. That's 20 years. One expert on female genital mutilation says she's worried that this authoritative-sounding article on the Muslim website could send the wrong message to Muslim families. Quote, it's putting a burden on these parents because now they are having to choose between maintaining adherence to the author's views, that is, to the Islamic views, versus the Canadian criminal code. Any cutting of the genitalia for non-medical reasons is prohibited and has been prohibited for 20 years. And the Muslims in Calgary website lists three local mosques, of which one of which hosts the Muslim Council of Calgary on its contacts page. The council said that it actually has nothing to do with the site. Nevertheless, they condemned the Jewish references in the article. However, this Muslim Calgary Council voiced support for the limited type of circumcision that the blog promotes. It says, female genital mutilation in the form that cuts the clitoris or inhibits a woman's ability to achieve sexual pleasure in any way is absolutely against Islam and the values it preaches. However, female circumcision in the form that removes the skin above the clitoris, thereby exposing it and enabling a woman to achieve more pleasure during the sexual act, is something that scholars in the Islamic world have recommended for many centuries. Well, indeed they have. The most reliable, authoritative manual of Sharia law translated into English called Reliance of the Traveler has a section where it says that one of the four schools of Sunni Sharia law says that female circumcision is mandatory. Another of the four schools says that it is not mandatory, not obligatory. However, it is strongly recommended. Another school says that female circumcision is done as a favor to the husband. And so there is definitely Islamic backing for female circumcision, and any of the Muslim spokesmen who say that this has nothing to do with Islam but is only a cultural practice, they are lying, because the manual for Sharia law says very specifically that it is Islamic. Not necessarily required. Some schools require it. Other schools say that it's only recommended. This Muslim in Calgary, the Muslim Council, said that Islam forbids the more severe forms of genital mutilation practiced in Africa. But the truth about female circumcision has been obscured by, quote, Islamophobic sentiments expressed by a largely Jewish-controlled media, unquote. Jews also want to hide the fact that limited female circumcision is another feather in the cap of Islam, the article says. So the article not only defends female circumcision, it blames the Jews for opposing it. So here we have Islamic anti-Semitism rising to the surface again, and this time the Muslims are defending female circumcision, even though it is explicitly prohibited according to Canadian law. Even when they advocate this so-called very limited female circumcision, there is no guarantee that the circumciser won't go farther, because it legitimizes the whole concept of genital mutilation. And the Jewish group in Calgary voiced dismay that the article was littered with classical anti-Semitic tropes. Now, another thing about the Jewish Council, Jewish Federation in Calgary, they have specifically defended Islam on many occasions, and they have criticized the appearance of Robert Spencer and other critics of Islam in Calgary. And here we see that the Jewish community is being blamed by the Muslims in Calgary, even though the Jewish community organization has supported Islam and Muslims against critics of Islam. So the Jewish community, as usual, is put in a very difficult position. On the one hand, they are against anti-Semitism, and here they see anti-Semitism coming from the Muslim community. On the other hand, they bend over backwards to defend Islam from criticism. Next item. This concerns integration. Now, the item comes from Bloomberg Press, and it's entitled, Europe's Muslims are more integrated than you think. Well, are they really? Let's talk about what they understand as integration. Remember, what we are really concerned about with Muslims are not how they look and how they dress and what professions they go into and their rates of unemployment or employment. That is not the issue. The issue is that they carry with them the ideology which fosters values that are contradictory to our values. And unfortunately, any time that the public talks about integration of Muslims, they do not talk about values. And this article is an example of that. And so here the article says that debates over immigration are fraught with misconceptions. One of the most common is that the integration of Muslims into societies in Western Europe has gone very badly, in large part because terror attacks loom so large in the news. Well, it is true that people pay too much attention to the terrorist attacks because that is not the major threat from Islam. Remember, we were talking about the three major threats from Islam. It's not terrorism. It is the stealth jihad and the gradual taking over of the country by the increasing Muslim population, which, of course, is Islamic and not Western. And so while the article says these attacks are a very real problem, but they do not reflect the typical reality. Well, this is true. Unfortunately, they don't understand what the typical reality is. We've seen that all over Europe there has been massive increase in crime and rape and assaults by the Muslim immigrants against the native populations in Germany and Sweden and elsewhere. This article doesn't talk about that. So this new study of immigrants comes from a German organization called the Bertelsmann Stiftung, and it shows, supposedly, that Muslim integration in Europe is in fact proceeding at a reasonable pace. But that's only because they are not measuring the right things. The survey included more than 1,000 Muslims in Germany and 500 in Austria, France, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. Now, that's, of course, a very tiny representation of Muslim immigrants, which amount to many millions in those countries. This is not the first study of its kind, and the results, it says, offer considerable hope for societies facing integration challenges. The stereotype of an uneducated, unemployed, easily radicalized Muslim migrant does not fit the facts. Well, in this sense, they may be correct. However, the criteria that they propose of uneducated, unemployed, and easily radicalized, that is not the right set of criteria. And the reason is that the fact is that Muslims are becoming very educated, and that makes them all the more dangerous. Not more integrated, because they're educated and they still adhere to their Islamic ideology. And when they're employed, so much the worse. They enter all the professions and they still carry with them their Islamic ideology. So it's not so much the fact that they are easily radicalized, but there will be those too. Remember this, imagine a bowl of M&Ms. You may have heard this analogy before, in which, say, only 3 or 4% of these M&Ms are deadly poison. Would you take a handful of them and eat them? Well, the answer is, of course not. But this is what is exactly going on with the Muslim immigrants. You may have only 3 or 4% who become terrorists, but that's not the issue. The fact is they do become terrorists, and why should we take in these Muslim immigrants? But the other 95% are the suspect ones, many of whom carry with them this deadly supremacist ideology of Islam, even if they're not terrorists. The article goes on to say, the first sign of integration is language skill. Well, that may be true, and the Muslims are learning the host language. They're learning English in the United States, they're learning German in Germany, and so on. However, that simply enables them to enter the society and spread their ideology all the more effectively and without being noticed. People see them and they say, oh, how nicely he speaks our language. And therefore they conclude that these people are part of our society. But they are not part of our society. In fact, they simply appear to be, because they're still carrying with them their ideology. That is the most important thing, and not language school. Graduation from high school, the article goes on to say, said this is about the same as for non-Muslims in the country. But again, graduation from high school is not the right criterion, because it doesn't tell us anything about the Muslims' values. The Muslims will still want Sharia law, and in fact, when this article shows that Muslims are so-called integrated because their employment rates, their graduation rates, and so on are similar to non-Muslims, that doesn't tell us what we really need to know. The fact is that opinion polls have shown us, and they're much broader polls than this 1,000 Muslims surveyed here, that the opinion polls have shown us that more than two-thirds of European Muslims want Sharia law to be the law of the land. This is what's important. It's a question of values. It's a question of Islamic supremacy. This is what the survey does not talk about. The survey goes on to say, well, these Muslims have report having frequent or very frequent social contact with non-Muslims. Okay, great. How relevant is that? The fact is that these Muslims have social contact. That simply means that they have social contact. It doesn't mean that they are integrating in terms of values. In fact, they retain their values, and in their social contact and professional contacts, they're helping to spread Islam and the influence of Islam and Sharia law. That is what's important, and not the fact that they have social contacts. The article goes on to say that they feel most of the vast majority of Muslim immigrants in Switzerland and Austria and elsewhere have a close connection to the countries they live in. What in the world is a close connection? How do we measure that? What does it mean? It doesn't mean loyalty. It means a close connection. That's different from loyalty. The loyalty is to Islam. Even though the article goes on to say that these Muslim immigrants consider their loyalty to Islam to be secondary to the country that they're living in, but that's simply false. We know that from reputable surveys, as I've mentioned, which show that two-thirds of the Muslim immigrants in Europe, at least two-thirds, want Sharia law. Well, that certainly indicates a loyalty to Islam, which is above the loyalty to the country that they live in. The article goes on to say integration is going relatively well in France. Well, that is obviously false, and here the article says that it's going relatively well because there are so few Muslim-related terrorist attacks. Well, of course, there may be only a handful, a dozen, half a dozen, a dozen, hundreds of people have been killed, and again, that takes away our attention from the fact that integration is not going well at all in France. We've got all of those suburbs around Paris, and in fact, there are considered to be about 700 no-go zones in France where the authorities dare not go because they will be subjected to violence, that is, fire and ambulance and police. This does not show integration. It shows, in fact, quite the opposite. It shows the development of parallel societies where the Muslims are dominant in those neighborhoods and in those cities, and they will introduce as much Sharia law as possible. That is not integration. And by focusing only on terrorism, this study totally misses the lack of integration of the Muslim communities. The article goes on to say that the good news is that Western European integration of Muslims is further along than many people believe. Well, that, again, is highly questionable for the reasons that we've stated. The bad news, the article goes on to say, is that the process of integration entails significant social change. Well, what does that mean? Yes, of course it entails social change. It means that Muslims have special privileges, that Muslims are given political privileges. In schools, the teachers are allowed to wear their Muslim religious clothing, and so on in many different ways. Social change. That means that many of the pupils in German schools, for example, are Muslims, and the German students must tolerate this. That has to do linguistically. There are problems for the German students now because of their fellow school children are no longer part of the German culture. They are part of the Muslim culture. It has to do with Muslim children, for example, not being allowed to take part in normal physical education classes in school because, well, Muslim girls are not allowed to dress in a normal way that non-Muslims would dress for physical education, and they're not allowed to mix with boys. There are many ways that social integration will not occur simply because of this so-called social change. So the notion of integration must be considered in the light of values and not in the light of merely terrorism or lack of terrorism. Another topic for today, what's the difference between a nun's habit and a hijab or a burqa? You will find that Muslim apologists will say that, well, there is no difference, that we should not be against the hijab or the burqa because, well, Catholic nuns also wear what is equivalent almost of a burqa, where they cover everything except their face and their hands. What's the difference? Well, we need to remember that any clothing really is sending a message to the society around it. This could be even for clothing that does not stand out. If clothing is just like everybody else wears, that's also a message that the wearer of the clothing is part of the cultural community around it. Any other clothing that does stand out sends a message also. It is a message that the wearer of the clothing is, in fact, loyal to, a representative of, an adherent of some organization or movement which uses that clothing as a symbol of identity and solidarity. For example, you have uniforms, a police uniform. Well, that identifies the wearer as a member of the police department. A uniform of United Parcel Service, UPS, or FedEx, they wear uniforms, and that identifies them as a member of the organization. A nurse's medical uniform or a doctor's medical uniform is also a form of identity with the organization. Well, what about other uniforms? Well, take the nun's habit. That is very clear. It's an identification of that woman with the Catholic Church and with the Catholic Church's doctrines and loyalty to the Catholic Church. Great. That is exactly what the hijab is, except that the hijab is not necessarily voluntary. It is, in fact, required by the Quran, which requires the Muslim women to cover up. The nun's habit is not required. The nun voluntarily enters the Catholic Church's order of nuns, and she covers up then voluntarily. And she identifies herself as a loyal member of the Catholic Church, dedicating her life to Jesus and to the Catholic Church. Well, similarly with the hijab and, of course, the burqa. What are they identifying with? They are identifying with Islam. The hijab is, in fact, required, as I mentioned, by the Quran, and therefore its symbolism means adherence to Sharia law, adherence to the Quran, and loyalty to the Islamic community. That is what the hijab means. It is not an article of clothing, merely. It is not a fashion statement, although there have been clothing companies which are trying to make it into a fashion statement. And contrary to Islamic propaganda, the hijab is not an expression of modesty. It is an expression of loyalty and submission to Allah. And if you read the actual Islamic sources where they talk about it, they will tell you that the hijab is a sign of submission to Allah, and that is the reason that Muslim women, many of them, wear the hijab, in order to show their submission to Allah. And therefore, behind the hijab is the ideology of Sharia law. This is what we need to remember. And while you could say, well, that's similar to a Catholic nun who shows adherence to the Catholic Church, yes, but then let's compare the ideologies that the Catholic nun supports and that the Muslim woman supports. The ideologies are totally different. There is nothing in the Catholic Church ideology which requires the nuns to make the whole world Catholic and to impose Catholicism by force. The hijab indicates adherence to Islamic ideology, which does require the Islamic community to take over the world by force if necessary. So it's the ideology behind the hijab that is so important. And the burqa, of course, is even more ideological than the hijab is. The burqa apparently is not required by Islamic law, although some people think it is. Some Muslim countries require it. For example, in any of the areas controlled by the Taliban and such militant organizations, it's required, but it's also required in Saudi Arabia. That's the burqa, not just the hijab. It's complete covering. It's required to a significant extent in the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is Shiite. They require women to cover up. And so it's a symbol, this clothing, a symbol of adherence to Sharia law. Now, if they're required by the state to cover up, you never know whether the Muslim woman who is wearing it really is adherence of Sharia law or not, because she's required by law to do it. In the West, however, where it's not required by law, any Muslim woman wearing the hijab or the burqa can be assumed to be a strong adherent of Sharia law and all of the supremacist ideology that Sharia law entails. That is the difference between the nun's habit and a hijab, and I hope that if you ever run into that argument, you will be able to explain it, that the nun's habit does not show adherence to a supremacist ideology, but the hijab does show adherence to the supremacist ideology. It shows subservience and submission to Allah and the Quran. That is the difference, and so we need to understand what, in fact, is in the Quran and what the ideology of Islam actually entails in order to understand what these women in hijab are supporting. Next topic. We have time for about one more, maybe two more topics. That is what's going on in the country of Myanmar. Myanmar, as you know, is former country of Burma. It's a country of about 55 million people, and it used to have a Muslim minority of about 1 million, so it's relatively small. It's about roughly 2% of the country, used to be. But there's been an enormous forced emigration of Muslims out of Myanmar because there have been numerous incidents where these Rohingya, as they're called, the Muslim minority in Burma, have their militant groups also, and they've been causing all kinds of terrorist acts against Myanmar's police forces. But it's also a Muslim minority, and a Muslim minority, like Muslim minorities everywhere, do not integrate. They are separate, and the Myanmar government is doing what it can in order to prevent the growth of Islam in Myanmar, and they are, in fact, it seems, persecuting the Rohingya minority. It seems to be that in the last several weeks, an estimated 270,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled to neighboring Bangladesh. Now, the Myanmar government claims that the Rohingya are in fact Bangladeshi and do not enjoy citizenship rights in Myanmar. The Bangladeshis say that the Rohingya are in fact Myanmar citizens and not Bangladeshi, but they're Muslims and they're apparently very closely related to the Bangladeshi Muslims. Many of them came from Bangladesh. They are now fleeing back to Bangladesh because, well, that's the border country, right bordering on the state, Rakhine state, where the Rohingya Muslims live. So it looks like at least a quarter of the population has now already fled to Bangladesh. The Muslims in Pakistan are rallying in solidarity with the Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims. As supporters of the Jamaat al-Islami party in Pakistan have demanded the expulsion of Myanmar's ambassador over the violence against the Rohingya ethnic minority in Myanmar. Who is the Jamaat al-Islami party? Well, this is a something equivalent to the Muslim Brotherhood in Asia. It was started by Abu Maududi in India many years ago, before the separation, in fact, of India and Pakistan in 1947. That's 70 years ago. So this party goes back a long way. They are an Islamist party which wants the establishment of total Sharia law throughout the country. They are very upset now about the persecution of Muslims in Myanmar. And the head of this Islamist party urged the Organization of Islamic Countries to pressure Myanmar to stop the violence against the Rohingya. The violence began on August 25th, that's the latest upsurge of violence, when the Rohingya insurgents attacked Myanmar police and paramilitary posts. And many of the Rohingya homes were burned, and an estimated 270,000 of them have fled to neighboring Bangladesh. This is causing an enormous tragedy for those who have fled, because they are leaving essentially with only the clothes on their back. They are undergoing starvation. They drown in the river that separates them from Bangladesh, and so there's enormous hunger and suffering here. Turkey and other Muslim countries have been trying to send aid to them and set up camps in Bangladesh, refugee camps in Bangladesh, in order to help these Rohingya Muslims. Turkish President Erdogan has promised more help for them, and Turkey plans to build safer and more livable camps in Bangladesh. They promised 10,000 tons of humanitarian aid. In Malaysia also, the officials say they are bracing for a possible influx of Rohingya Muslims, refugees, because of renewed violence in Myanmar. Also in Indonesia, there's an attempt to help. And Malaysia, which is already a home to thousands of people from Myanmar, including 56,000 Rohingya Muslims, they are cautious of being swamped by an influx of more Rohingya refugees. And thousands of Muslims in the Indian-controlled portion of Kashmir. Now, you remember that the Muslims in Kashmir want to overthrow the Indian government and to ally with Pakistan, because the Muslims nowhere are willing to be subservient to a non-Muslim government. And in Kashmir, there's an active separatist group among the Muslims, just like in the Philippines, by the way, to separate from India and to make Kashmir a Muslim country. And so they are also rallying against the persecution of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. Thousands of Indonesian Muslims held a rally also to condemn the violence in Myanmar against minority Rohingya Muslims. So you see Muslims all over are coming out to demonstrate against the persecution of Muslims, but you will never see them come out to demonstrate against the persecution by Muslims of non-Muslims, which is going on, of course, all over Pakistan and Egypt, and of course in the ISIS-controlled areas in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. So it's strictly one-sided that the Muslims in other countries are protesting the persecution of Muslims, but they will never protest the persecution of non-Muslims by Muslims. I think perhaps that should be all for today. We'll continue next week. We have a number of interesting topics yet to deal with. There is, of course, the struggle against the Muslim rebels in the Philippines. And there are a number of topics. Well, I will be advertising on Facebook and on my email list. And please, if you're interested, send me your email again to ideologyofislam@cox.net, and I will send you the announcements for next show. You can also listen to the archives of this show at the website indicated in my announcement. Again, I'll be happy to send that to you. Please listen to it. Help spread the word about Islam to our fellow citizens. We need you. We need every American citizen to become active and knowledgeable about Islam, because Islam is a threat. It's a threat through mass Muslim immigration, because the Muslim communities do not assimilate in terms of values. Again, they assimilate in terms of profession and language, but that makes it all the more difficult to understand that their values are not our values. So please, help our fellow citizens to understand the nature of Islam. We need to spread the word, and we need you to help spread the word. Thank you. We'll talk to you again next week, 10 o'clock Arizona, California time, 1 o'clock p.m. New York time. Thank you, and have a great week. Bye-bye.